Welcome to Beat the Block, a podcast powered by BeatStars, the world's number one marketplace to buy and sell beats.
This is a show where we go deeper than the surface and talk about the best producers and artists in the game, not just about their successes, but also the blocks, dark times, mental health, and unpaid work that comes along with it.
More importantly, we find out they bounce back and turn their downsides into upsides to make a career out of doing what they love so you can too.
Get ready to experience this episode of Beat the Block. What's good, everybody? This is Ill Brown.
Your man Trox.
Yo, this is Candy.
And you are live with us during the Beat the Block podcast. What better place could you fucking be right now? Anyway, today we have a special guest. You've heard his music with the likes of Kanye West, Dr. Dre, Boy Wonder, Cameron, so many more, man. Don't even fucking have to name them and shit. Everybody, please give a warm welcome for the corporate assassin, producer extraordinaire, MTK. Everybody give it up.
Hey. Thank you.
How you feeling today, man? Are you corona-ing safely? I just made that word up.
Oh, man, I'm in Seattle, so we've been sheltering in place for a hot minute. And I'm taking it real seriously. My wife's worked in medicine her whole life, so I don't have the luxury of ignorance. So taking it seriously, washing my hands the right way, all the good stuff.
Got to, man. So without further ado, let's jump right in.
Yeah, we ready to dive in and find out some more info about MTK, how you started your career. I know that you juggled your music career with a corporate job, which a lot of people are trying to figure that shit out. Like, how do you balance between the two? I know you started your corporate job in college, right?
I started working in fraud. Like, if you've ever lost your debit card and you have to call someone to get it canceled, I was that guy. And I was working night shift. So I was working like 3-10s. And I would have that graveyard shift for the rest of the week. So I couldn't really deviate from the sleep schedule. And, you know, after like 2 weeks, I'm like, man, if I don't get a hobby, I'm going to go effing crazy. So I bootlegged Fruity Loops. And I'm like, I'm going to just give this whole making beats thing. A friend of mine, Danny Biorlo, actually, shout out to him. He gave me like 20-30 records to start off with, and I was like flipping Commodore samples and things like that. But that's how I started.
So where did you do fraud at? Like, what, it was a bank?
I worked for I'm gonna bore someone to sleep with this one. I worked for a third party subsidiary that was contracted out by a lot of different credit unions. So United States Senate Credit Union, Screen Actors Guild Credit Union, because all those people can't afford to have people on staff.
So you were doing a graveyard shift and you got a crack of Fruity Loops. Like, what computer did you install that on? Was it the work computer?
No. I went and I bought a Ballin' on a Budget e-machines, if you remember those. It's like you could buy a computer for like $400.
E-machines, baby.
Back in the day.
Yes, sir.
Yep, it worked.
That's dope.
It was hot trash, but, you know, I could run like 3 sound fonts at a time on Fruity Loops before it crashed. But I mean, it got the job done and it allowed me to articulate my ideas when I first started. So that's all that really matters.
So working that shift, I mean, I can imagine. I actually used to do collections. So I did collections in college and we had our fraud department like right on the same floor on the other side. That's why I asked. I'm like, wait a minute, what bank was it? But I didn't do that graveyard shift. So I could imagine being there and you probably didn't get too many calls during that time frame. Was that what motivated you to like really try to find something to do, get your head start on making beats?
Yeah, I mean, it allowed me to, I would do my homework, you know, like a lot of kids do with their college jobs, but there's only so much homework that you can do in one night before you're like either, hey, I don't want to do it, or I'm done. So then I would just start researching records and I'd go on sites like TheBreaks.com, Soul Strut, And I wouldn't make music at work, but I would do research on records and samples. And that's where I cut my teeth. And that's where I found out about people around me that were doing stuff like I wanted to do, like guys like Jake One, him and DJ Supreme, Conmin, what they were putting out, the sample tapes and all that good stuff. And I was expanding my palette of records and also expanding my idea of what I could possibly do with this if I tried hard enough.
So when you got off of work, you just took those ideas and went straight to the dorm or your crib and then got to work.
Yeah.
Was it like excitement when you got off of work? Like, I can't wait to get to work so I can dive right in and make these beats from these ideas.
So when I would get to work, I'd be like, I can't wait to research stuff. I can't wait to find out, like, who did what, like what records, like Isaac Hayes produced for someone else, finding stuff out like that. And then when I get home, I'd have like 10, 12 hours of ideas just like locked and loaded right in my head. And I was only sleeping like 4 hours a night because I was just so focused on getting these ideas out. And man, in hindsight, they were garby. They were trash, but they were all necessary, like iterative steps to get to the next thing.
Right. So how would you manage your time, like with class and then work and then coming home to be creative? Because it's like using a different part of your brain, trying to focus on, you know, getting through your schoolwork and then going to work. You know, when you clock in, you got to stay focused for a little bit of time, at least until nobody's paying attention. And then get back to the crib and then cook up.
I think a lot of it is just realizing what's important. Going to school, important. Going and getting a paycheck, important. Doing music, important. Everything else, not so much. So if you cut out TV, if you cut out a lot of the social stuff, I wouldn't recommend doing this, but it's just how I did it.
Right.
And you cut out a lot of those, like, what I considered at the time to be unnecessary distractions. It was easy because I would just do any mixture of those three things on any given day. And I might play some old video games or something like that to kind of pass the time. But other than that, my focus was exclusively on work, school, music.
Yeah. That's super dope that you were able to maintain that level of like concentration on what it was that you were trying to do. A lot of people that are in school, they try to take advantage of that college lifestyle. So getting involved on campus or playing sports and then trying to balance out doing what they really want to do, as well as trying to hold down a job. And it's just like, how do you manage the time? So basically your key was to just cut all the rest out. I think most of us are introverts anyway, as creatives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it kind of works out in the end anyway. So the few beats that you did were like trash at first. Like, how long did it actually take you to make something you were confident in?
I'll let you know. No, I'm just joking. It hasn't taken me that long. I would say, like, I started in like 2003. I was 20 years old. So I started a little later than everyone else. I'd say I was really confident around 2006. I went to do a beat battle called Red Bull Big Tune, which is pretty legendary at this point. That's how I met Trox.
Yep.
I played a couple beats and I got like a really big crowd response. Other than that, I had never like really played anything for anyone outside of like, I posted it like on rapmusic.com and someone's like, yeah, this shit's trash. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to post anything for a minute. I need to get my chops up. So yeah, it took me at least 3 years. And then I got too full of myself. I went the complete wrong direction because I got the big reactions and, you know, then I had to get humbled down by the big homies and all that. But it took me about three and a half years, four years maybe.
So during the whole 3 years of you making beats, what kept you going? Because ego is like a big part of what we deal with, especially in the beginning of you creating. Like, you think your shit is dope, and then somebody tells you, like, that shit is trash, and then it kills your soul. Like, sometimes people don't ever come back from doing something, like, if posting a beat and they're hearing that their shit is trash. A lot of people don't come back from that. Like, they think that is just not for them. So, like, what actually motivated you to, like, keep making beats?
I would say understanding that the feedback from others is fickle and maybe based on a lot of things other than what you're actually doing, maybe based on their opinion of themselves, how they're feeling. They may be projecting a little bit. So that's one thing that helps me temper. Even now when people are like going out of their way to be like really nice to me, I try to keep that kind of stuff in context and consideration. But the falling in love with the work itself is what helped keep me going those years. So realizing that, okay, this beat was trash, but the snare is actually pretty good. Or the hi-hats cut through the mix just the right way. And the sample chop is really good, but everything else stinks. And just waiting until the stuff that's good starts to level out and exceed the stuff that's bad. And just seeing that entire process play out over, you know, your 10,000 hours or whatever is way more exciting than someone saying something nice about it. It's just the adventure and like figuring it out on your own. So that's what kept me going.
I think that back in 03, we weren't quite yet at this stage of like having instant results and instant gratification. I think we phased into that probably about 5 years later, 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. But now it's like most people really can't understand that it's a process and you keep working at it. It's since everything is about instant gratification, people's egos get killed like extremely quick. So it was cool at 20, you were able to figure out that it's a journey and it's not just I'm about to make some beats and immediately get displacement or, you know, figure it out so quickly. So that's really cool that you were able to figure that one out. So you ended up leaving school. Did you graduate or you just...
You want to know, it's really sad. I'm one credit short.
One credit?
Literally, I'm one class.
Oh,
I'm
damn.
One class short.
Can we ask, what is it, an elective? Is it like a...
No. It's algebra.
Algebra?
Algebra.
Oh, shit.
I hate algebra.
I hate math, period.
Yeah, I'm really good at like at multiplication and stuff like that, arithmetic, but algebra just kills me.
Boring.
I've highly considered, you know, hiring a lookalike to come in and just take it in my place, but I never did. So no, I never graduated, but I'm close.
So what happened in that transition? You worked at the job you were creating and then you were in school and decided to transition. Well,
what really made me quit was I had saved up a decent amount of money and I decided that I wanted to travel the world, right? I had a couple friends who were fishermen, and so they don't really work normal schedules. They're crab fishermen. So we spent a lot of time in like Eastern Europe and Asia, right? So I was actually making beats while I was out there. I wanted to travel more than I wanted to sit inside a room because I've been doing that for so long, for like 3 years. It's like, I need to get out for a little while. So I ended up transitioning away from the job and the school to go travel. And I was making beats in like Latvia. I made beats in Bosnia, just like bootlegging Fruity Loops on the computers when I would get there at the internet cafes. That's really what caused the transition at first. And I was getting okay. I was like closer to good than not, but I was still kind of like mids, you know. I was still like $5 a gram good. But the traveling is really what made me decide to pivot.
Were you getting inspiration from all those countries you visited?
Yeah, I was listening to records. I was record shopping a little bit while I was there and mailing it home, getting to hear what other people like, especially in Eastern Europe, like the rap music, and seeing like flyers on the, like when you're walking around town and seeing like the Beat Nuts are like playing and like somewhere super random in Croatia or wherever, it makes you realize just how what you're trying to be a part of is so much bigger than you could ever hope to be.
Yeah, that's super dope. Do you have a favorite like record that you've picked along your travels? Any favorite Latvian record?
Oh yeah, I got a few. One of my favorite records is by Hideki Saijo and it's called Lola. I used it for an outer space record on Baby Grand Records called Gods and Generals 2. Frank Dukes used it for a Big Tunes battle, a couple other people used it. So that one, that's a Japanese record though. But I found it when I was in Eastern Europe. There's a lot of Polish records that I found where it sounded kind of like what the Beatnuts were doing back in the day, you know, like with the vocals and like the crazy lyrics, like the like voices are like saying the crazy like phrases and things like that. So stuff like that is what I found, but I couldn't pronounce the names if I had a gun to my head and right. my life depended on it.
I could imagine looking at those records like, what the hell is this?
Oh, man, my friend Eric Vanderslice is, I would say, one of the key experts on Eastern European music, specifically as it comes to sampling and things like that. When I got back from traveling, I started becoming friends with him. And like we would talk about some of the stuff that I found. I always thought that was really cool that I knew someone that actually understood like how big like some like fake Partridge Family, you know, type thing from Yugoslavia in the 1980s was. But if anyone knew, it was going to be him.
That's crazy. So what was like the wildest thing that happened to you along your travels?
So I did the Running of the Bulls. I'm the fattest, slowest guy out of all my friends. I'm the only one who didn't get hit. I'm smart. I'm strategic. So I did the Running of the Bulls. That was crazy. I saw someone's leg get snapped in half. I saw someone's neck get broke when I was out there. That was like fucking nuts. I wish... Oh, my mom doesn't hear this because I don't think I've shared those stories.
You're
with
a really brave man.
I have no sense. I have an exceptional risk threshold. The craziest thing I ever did traveling, though, was a couple years later. I partnered with a company called The Adventurist. And what we did is we would do these extreme travel situations for charity. So we did one for Frank Water, which is like a clean water initiative in Africa and India. And we took a tuk-tuk, which is like a little, like basically a motorcycle with a bench on the back. It's like 7 horsepower. My fisherman friends and I, we took that from Kathmandu, Nepal, drove through the Himalayas with it, and drove through the eastern seaboard of India. When we got there in Kathmandu, they were having a Maoist coup. So the president at the time got ousted. We saw a couple bombs go off, saw a car bomb go off, and we ended up flipping our tuk-tuk at about 45 miles an hour while we were in like Mumbai or something like that. Like the right-hand side of my leg kind of like, it was a little rough.
Damn.
You know, I got scraped up a little bit. After we crashed, I thought I was good. And we get out. I'm like, man, I am so lucky that nothing happened to me. Then my friend Jay says, oh, man, Matt's hurt real fucking bad. Look at his leg. I'm like, oh, I just can't feel it. Okay, I see what's going on right now.
Fuck, man.
Yeah, I went there. I went to Serbia. I went through Kosovo. I went through Bosnia. A lot of the places aren't as bad as you think they're going to be. I had a lot of fun doing it. I kind of missed doing it, honestly, but... with a wife and kid, it's a little bit hard now. So, yeah, I'd say the trip in Nepal in India and running with the bulls, those are my two favorites that are high risk.
Yeah, they're super high risk.
Wow.
But it sounds pretty awesome. How long did you travel for? 50 countries and what period of time?
Yeah.
Like,
I did that over the course of 2 trips. The first trip was like 6 months and the second trip was like a month and change. So I wasn't the only country I really spent a lot of time in, or the only city I spent a lot of time in, was Riga, Latvia. And I spent a decent amount of time in a place called Delft in the Netherlands, which is actually like right by where young Keo grew up.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty awesome. So I'm pretty sure that you were extremely inspired by your trips, got a lot of adventure. And you said you traveled with some fishermen.
Yeah, a couple of my friends are crab fishermen, or they were. One of them was on the Deadliest Catch. And so I used to hang out with all those guys, too. I used to go play craps with Uncle Phil, or not Uncle Phil, his name, Captain Phil. I used to play craps with Captain Phil on Christmas morning. It was never planned. We just show up to the same tribal casino at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and we see him looking all like throwing dice, and we'd be looking the same way. It's like, what are you doing on Christmas morning playing craps? But we were. So, yeah, crab fishermen are crazy.
Wow.
They are insane. But they're good friends.
That's really dope. How do you think you grew from, like, that travel experience? And
I think I realized, I think it was one of my first real introductions to privilege. and having my own privileges thrown directly in my face. And being aware of those has changed the way I moved and the way I would interact with people. Because I had that typical, like, poor white trash chip on my shoulder. It's like, well, I went and I did this and blah, 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 blah. No one could tell me nothing. It's like, well, it's not that simple. So having that thrown in my face was really, really good for me personally and helped me become a far more empathetic person. And just having patience, I would say, would be the next thing. Because things didn't always go smoothly or how we wanted them to go. And rolling with the punches was a really big, it was a determining factor in all of us having a good trip. So recognizing privilege and developing patience.
I had an opportunity when I was in college. I went to China. It was in 06. Oh, wow. So I stuck out college. I didn't drop out. 5 years, got the degree in business, which I started creating as a kid. And I ran into that time management issue. I had like a Triton in my dorm room that I never touched. It collected dust, and all the guys that was in my dorm building would like run past my room and be like, oh, she got a Triton. But I didn't make no beats the whole time. And out of the whole 5 years, I didn't touch it at all. But I did get a chance to travel to China, and that experience opened me up a lot. It was like understanding the privilege. I can relate to that. Having more patience. I was like the youngest person on the trip. Everyone else was in their 30s. They were grad students, had corporate jobs for real, like full time with kids. So I was the young chick that was just reckless, pretty much reckless. But I learned a lot from them, and it kind of changed my mindset as well. So I can totally relate to that. But diving back in after you created while you were out traveling and then you got home, like, how did you take that and then jump back in to music full time at home once you got home?
You know, honestly, I had had so many, you know, I was talking about when I first started, I'd come home from work and I'd have all the ideas in my head. Well, I had like 6 months of those, basically. Because I couldn't do everything that I wanted to do. I was always just working with the best that I could throw together. So working, it was very easy. It was seamless. I needed to find another job, of course. And I ended up working at Expedia.com for a while around this time. But working the corporate, it was the same gig as before. Work the corporate job. Thankfully, I had better hours. I didn't have to work graveyard anymore. But focusing on music, focusing on work to keep my lights on. And now that school wasn't an issue, I just had more time to focus on the things that were really important to me, which was music, and pretty much exclusively that.
Go home, make beats, go to work. That was pretty much it.
Yeah.
You got to be disciplined.
Life.
Yeah.
That's like super key.
I had to, like a lot of my friends, I remember one of my traveling friends, he would call me up and he's like, hey man, what are you doing? He's like, if you say that you're making beats, I'm going to come over there and I'm going to slap you in the head. And I'd be like, I'm making beats. And, you know, back then I still was kind of like, I was mids. So I was still in the mids category, but it didn't feel like I needed to be disciplined. I didn't feel like I needed to, because I mean, I would still go and I'd like eat at a restaurant or something like that with my friends. But, you know, the majority of my time was spent focusing on my passion. And since I was passionate about it, it didn't feel like I was, you know, doing anything extraordinary.
It doesn't feel forced when you're passionate about it.
It's easy.
Yeah, we can relate.
Absolutely.
I bet you can.
See, that's dope, man. What led you to your meteoric rise in the ranks of the music industry, man? How did you start rising through?
By failing miserably. So I had a decent run as a producer, you know, through like the 2000s, I did all right. I ended up like talking with like the folks at G-Unit. I'd fly out there. I went to the office. Like I saw the end of Club Diamond plaque, all that good stuff. You know, I was like sending stuff to Shady and nothing ever came of it. And like I flew out to New York and stopped hearing from people. And I kept on trying to like really, really hard to make my production career work. But it clearly wasn't. And it stopped being fun And it started being me imposing this like idea of what I had to accomplish in order to feel like the last, at this point, like 12, 13 years were worth it. So falling flat on my face and failing miserably is what started it. And my wife telling me that if you're not having fun with it, just stop doing it. And just feeling this like immense pressure relief, you know, an instant relief. Just like, oh, well, I failed. Okay, I guess that happened. But it was fun. And when I changed my perception, it completely changed everything. So I, you know, had known Frank Dukes for a long time and had always admired what he did and the way he transitioned. So I always thought it was a cool idea to be able to compose these little loops. So I started doing it. And again, I started off and it was big trash. But I was having fun with it, just like I did when I first started making beats. And that just led to me throwing, you know, spaghetti at the wall, seeing what stuck. And then I finally felt confident sending stuff to producers and asking them to flip them. And I still had that, you know, like network of people that I knew when I was a producer. And now that I'm approaching them as someone that can help them, I was getting a lot of traction with people that I probably wouldn't have otherwise got. So going ass up was the best thing that helped me become successful.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, I know that feeling of failing, not hearing from cats when you're in their city. Like it can mm-hmm. be really discouraging, man. Like, I think we've all been there. I think I can speak for everybody on this panel that we've all been there and that feeling sucks.
Yeah. A mutual friend of ours actually went to Los Angeles, flew out specifically to meet with one A&R. Spent hundreds of dollars on a ticket, hundreds of dollars on a hotel. A&R ghosted him the whole time. Ended up losing like $1,000.
Ah.
Yeah.
Damn. So I want to take it back. I don't think we talked about Big Tune enough. So you join your first beat battle. First of all, explain how Red Bull Big Tune works for those that don't know.
Okay. So Red Bull Big Tune is basically a modernized take on the Jamaican sound clash of, you know, you play your rhythm and someone else plays theirs. And it's a back and forth. It's a competition. It was started by John Moore, rest in peace, DB1, Jake 1, Vitamin D, and Marcus Lilario from Seattle. And you would play your beat. Like if I was battling Trox, I would play mine. Trox would play his. Then I would play a rebuttal to Trox. And then Trox would play a rebuttal to mine. Then at the end of it, I would be brought to the front of the stage, just like Trox would. And they'd say, the host, like John Moore, would be like, okay, did MTK win? And the crowd would go, rah. And then I said, did Trox win? Like, yeah. And it's 100% crowd-based on who goes forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the best trial by fire to know if you're good or if you're not.
Oh, my God. Like, nah. Like, it definitely put my perspective in check for sure. My first time there, I made it to the semis my first time. I was actually surprised because like I didn't even expect to make it my first time. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? I was a nobody. I was going after veterans like you. Like I was going after cats like Brainstorm and Rising Sun and like Marcus mm-hmm. D and all those cats. You know what I'm saying? Like
mm-hmm.
heavy hitters. So how did it feel like having the crowd on your side? Like, did you just get some certain kind of high out of it? I mean, it's like 500 people in front of you just like going wild.
It blew my mind. So the first night that I did Big Tunes, I was going up against a guy named D-Black, who now goes by Nassim.
Yep.
And his production partner, B. Brown. And they won. I didn't make it past the first round, but the first beat I played, I got a big reaction from. And I was like, okay, cool. Then the second beat I played, I got a big reaction, not only from the crowd, but I got a big reaction from the host. And guys like Jake, Vitamin, and Jay Moore are not in the business of being, you know, easily impressed. So getting validation from those guys who were like heroes and also getting it from the crowd is one of the most intense feelings I've probably ever had in my life. And even though I lost, I got off stage and I had people dapping me up, like just to kind of put it in perspective. Like that night, I met Eric G, I met Macklemore, I met Brainstorm, I met Jake One, I met Vitamin D, I'm at DV1 and like a million other people in like 10 minutes after walking off stage because everyone was telling me how much they liked what I did.
I'm sure you've developed relationships outside of Seattle after that. Because they were dropping videos. They were dropping videos of every battle at that point at Red Bull Big Tune. They were literally, they had on their website, they had videos of each and every battle from every division, Seattle, LA. And your name was on there. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. And you just naturally gravitate towards the other people that are there, like Vanderslice. You know, I remember hearing him. I remember seeing the video where Vanderslice beat Illmind in like the first round or something like that. And Just Blaze runs out on stage, like going crazy over the beat that Vanderslice plays, like stuff like that. Like to be that close to like your heroes. Like the first one that Trox did, DJ Battlecat was there.
Yeah.
And that's who like the celebrity beat battle guy was.
It was Battlecat and Quick.
Oh, that's right. It was Battlecat and DJ Quick.
Yeah.
And like to be around that and to just be like a random dude making beats in your like your bedroom, and then you get to like rub shoulders with like dudes like who did record, like Battlecat did a full record with Tom Jones,
right?
Like, he's legit like in a million ways, like it's unreal. He had Crocs on that had blue paisley. He had Crip and Crocs. Dude's a superstar
for real.
To be around someone like that is just, it never ceases to amaze me how many people started from that and how many, like the way the music industry has been shaped since then by those beat battles and what guys like Jake Vitamin and John Moore did is just incredible. And it's like, it's a legacy that in a lot of ways probably brought me on this podcast, because that's how Trox and I really got to know each other.
Definitely. First of all, I want to say rest in peace to John Moore.
Yes.
Millions of people could not have done what he did. He shaped the industry, and I don't think he knew it at that time. You know what I'm saying? I don't think any of them cats knew it at that time. But you look at the results now, you're seeing Frank Dukes topping the charts. And, you know, he won it all one year. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And he wasn't even making those samples at that time. He was just chopping records.
No.
It's crazy.
It's the thing that people don't know. Like, I'd say, like, as far as, like, sampled beats, Frank Dukes is probably one of the best people I've ever heard.
For real.
He gets it. He gets it. Like, I remember listening, he'd send me beats that he did with like just actual records, and I'd be like, man, like I really need to step it up. I remember the G-Unit people told me, like Tony G from G-Unit said to me, you know what? If you want to really keep up, you got to keep up with Illmind, Cardiac, and Frank Dukes. It didn't happen.
That's a tough crowd.
It's a tough crowd, man.
That's crazy. Yo, what up, Ill Brown? I'm thinking of signing up for B-Stars. What's your experience like?
Man, bro, B-Stars came through for me at a tough time, man. Of course, the industry is much different now. It gave me a platform where I didn't have to build my own website, and I was able to upload my beats and sell them and engage with the community, man. I had a crazy first month, man. Did like 4K in sales.
Wow.
And I've been a fan and a member of BeatStars ever since. Sign up on BeatStars to start making money with your beats. Go to bit.ly/beattheblock1. Again, that's bit.ly/beattheblock1. Peace.
So, after this beat battle, what else did you do to elevate your career at that time? So you mentioned going to the G-Unit office, you know, meeting with Tony G, Dre McKenzie. I had that same experience myself. What was that like for you?
Wow. It was really cool because you walk in and like you see the Get Rich or Die Trying plaque. You see a cooler full of Formula 50 and you look and like, and they're walking you through and like, oh, that's 50's office. And you see like a white set inside an empty room and you're like, oh, word, okay. And you just see all that stuff and it just blows your mind. It's validating in a word. Like I can actually go to New York and go to a label and have a real meeting. And like I'm playing my beats. They're telling me they like them or they don't. And then they say, well, this is who you compete with. And they start playing me like beats by like S1 and J.R. Rotem at the time was like one. Those were like the dudes, you know, they still are. But
yeah,
it's validating. And it's also exciting just to be on that level. Unbelievable.
Oh, absolutely. Just being in that office was crazy. I was just, it was Dre McKenzie that got me in. Actually, how mm-hmm. I got in with G-Unit was I cold called Tony G on an email, just sent him beats just on a random. And I didn't think he'd listen. He listens to everything. You know what I'm saying? So he's like, man, mm-hmm. I love these. I CC'd Dre McKenzie. Please send more. And they were accepting send space links at that time. Yes, wow. Rest in peace. Like, the average A&R would only accept attachments. They were accepting send space. Shout out to G-Unit for that. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't even, like, I actually secured some songs with 50 before I actually went to the G-Unit office, which was crazy.
I never did a song, and you got it. And I still got to go. But
didn't you do a song with Lloyd Banks, though?
I did a song with Havoc and Lloyd Banks. Okay. Yeah, I remember that was the first, like, industry placement that I had ever had. And I was eating at an Einstein bagel, and someone texted me. I'm like, I'm proud of you, bro. I'm like, what? What are you talking about, man? Like, I ain't doing nothing. And then they sent me a YouTube link, and I was like, I was listening to it like on my like shitty ass flip phone or whatever, and it was insane.
And they didn't even tell you about it.
Of course not. They still don't tell me about it.
Oh, my God. It's like the mixtape era, man. It fucked a lot of shit up, man.
Mm-hmm.
I almost had a song with Lloyd Banks, too. Like, Tony G actually told me that he wanted it. Like, that's a rarity. Like, between you and me, we probably have an album's worth of work with G.
Probably. I always assume that if I had, like, if the A&R's hitting you back, then someone's recording to your stuff.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, it's I wouldn't consider it real until they ask for your publishing.
So it never was real with G Unit with me, because I never got a check or nothing. But it was a good experience.
Yeah, man.
Again, it helped me feel like I'm actually doing this.
I mean, it is, man. It's just having those records under your belt, man. It gives some kind of weight to your name. Mm-hmm. Like I don't regret doing those records with 50 at all.
It's one of those things where, just as a producer, like having the weight of someone like that on your credits, like I don't know if you got paid or you didn't get paid, any of that doesn't matter. That's all secondary. Being able to say that, you know, you've done like 3-4 songs with 50 or something like that.
3 of them.
And not a lot of people can say that. And 50 back then was like, even he wasn't like in the club space anymore, but he was still huge.
Absolutely.
Huge. Still selling gang of records. And those mixtapes, when those came out, like the Big Ten or whatever, and people went nuts over those.
Yeah, it's some of the best music he made.
Yeah, just being a part of projects on that level, that changes your beat price when you shop locally.
It does.
Absolutely.
That changes when you reach out to an AR and you keep cold calling folks. You can say, oh, well, I did this song for 50 Cent. How many emails did you open with that?
Oh, yeah. At that time, so many. Probably every email that involved sending beats.
Yeah, I bet. I used to do the same thing.
You told me a story about Sean Price.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you two. So the first one, I was working at Tommy Bahama doing fraud. And I was Tommy Bahama corporate, so I'm in like this plush, like tropical office. And I keep on hitting Sean Price, like, when am I going to get paid for that beat? And I was broke at the time. I was so poor and I really needed that check. And it wasn't going to be more than like $500 probably. But, you know, Sean was really patient with me until it wasn't. He was like, hey, you know what, man? Fuck you. Fuck your beat. Keep your raggedy ass shit. And he's calling me and he's like ripping into me and he sounds just like he does on the records. And he's just like cutting like a promo on me. He's like giving me bars. And I'm sitting here and I'm like underneath this palm tree just getting sunned like a motherfucker by Sean Price. And he's just telling me, he's like, you know, fuck you. I don't want to deal with your whack ass. And I was like, Sean, please calm down. I understand where you're coming from, and maybe I was a little bit too forthright, you know, blah, 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 and I calmed him down. And so that's one Sean Price story I have. Second Sean Price story, I had sent him this beat where it was a sample from Dr. Hook that said, some men need killer weed, some men need cocaine. And he loved it. And he told me that he'd written a verse for Druha to rap on it. About being white. And the whole verse was Druha talking about like white Benz, you know, white sheets, white shoes, white freaks. And he's like, he rapped, like drew on his verse to me. And I was like, okay, there's no one's touching this beat. No one's touching this beat. I get a call from this local rapper named Macklemore at the time. And he's like, hey man, I really want this beat. And I'm like, man, no, Drew Haas is going to rap on this beat. He's like, are you sure? It's like, I really want this. I'm like, no. This is Drew Haas and Sean Price. Clearly, that's the best decision to make in this situation. So that's my second Sean Price story. The third is he almost shot somebody. I was outside of, no snitching. The guy probably had it coming, though. I was outside of a club. Sean and Ill Bill had just performed. Ill Bill had gone back to the hotel room, and Sean's out, you know, commiserating with the people and whatnot. Like, this is, like, around the same time I had done that beat that I told Macklemore he couldn't have. And he was like, oh, that's you? Who did that? So he's chopping it up with me, real social, you know, real nice guy. And he's smoking a blunt outside the venue. And this guy, out of nowhere, comes up and he sounded like the Geico duck. And he's like, hey man, you guys smoking a blunt over here. And he's like walking up right behind Sean Price, like walking up behind him. He's like this far from Sean. So I see Sean turn around with his hand in his jacket. He's like, hey yo, what the fuck, fam?
He's like, what, fam? I just wanted to hit the blunt.
And he's like, and Sean's just like, nah, man, you can't run up on people like that. You almost got clapped, fam. He's like, and Sean's like, he's like, why your voice sound like that, fam? And he was just talking. This guy had literally sounded like the Geico duck. And it was insane. And he really was kind of violating, you know, by the space. Yeah, it's like, don't walk up behind people, especially if you're like high and paranoid and feeling weird and stuff in a city you don't reckon, like not your city.
Yo, especially in 2020. Holy shit, this coronavirus shit going on. Yeah,
right.
I had one last Sean Price story. I went to a local illegal weed shop and I brought him over some stuff because I was in the area and he didn't have time to leave the hotel. And it was the last time I ever talked to him. And I got to meet Ruck.
Oh, shit.
Like, I'm 6'5", and I still looked up to Ruck like this. Like, that dude's, like, insanely tall.
Guy's like a power forward in the NBA.
Yeah, like, he's power forward tall. And you know, I talked with Sean. I talked, his wife, Bernadette, was on FaceTime on the iPad. And back then, Sean Price's iPad email signature was sent from my iPad, bitch. So every email that I would get from him, sent from the iPad, would end with that. So Sean was a good dude, and it's really unfortunate that he passed so young.
Rest in peace to Sean Price, man. I definitely miss him and his music.
R.I.P.
He's just one of those guys that would just bar you out. Just bar you out, straight up, bar you out. You got any crazier ones at all?
I would say the Sean Price, I'm not really that close to the rap life, man. I remember one time I was at a place called Chop Suey in Seattle, and it was a Slum Village concert. Jay Dilla had died, I think, like a year and a half before. Mm. So I'm sitting with Elzai, who I later got to know better through Instagram, actually. And I'm being introduced to Elzai, and this guy's like, so, you know, just so you know, like, this guy's like, he's so good. He reminds me of, and I'm like, don't say it. God, don't say it. It's like, he really reminds me of Dilla. And he starts explaining to me, and I'm like, oh, no.
Nah.
Like, don't do it. Don't do it. So anyways, you could see Elle's eyes kind of like uncomfortable. And then this girl comes up and interrupts him, and she starts telling Elzai how much she loves him. And she's got like some like white crust around her nostril and stuff. And you can see there's like some dried blood. And she like loses her shit basically and starts yelling at Elzai. And he's like, Elzai's a very calm guy. And he's like, you need to just kind of calm down. And then she went to the corner and started punching the wall. And then she ran out the back door screaming. That's rap life for you. When you hang out backstage,
that's a real rap life right there. Holy shit.
Rap life, word is bond.
I wanted to ask you, what happened in the years after the G-Unit disappointment?
Struggle. I tried to make beats, and each year they progressively got more derivative. I was trying to make like type beats, not like posting them as type beats. And I don't have anything against type beats. I love type beats, but I was failing at them. And I was, when people are like, when A&Rs tell you like, we need a club banger that's like a 2045 version of Black and Yellow by Wiz Khalifa. Like nowadays I look at that like, yeah, no. But back then I'd like really try and do that because I was desperate. So they were desperate and they were not fruitful. And it was just frustrating because I'm trying so hard to get the stuff done. But since my efforts were disingenuous, I wasn't getting any sort of result.
Yeah, it was kind of going against like your natural sound, your natural flow.
Yeah.
I totally understand that. I think we all have been through that cycle as well at some point.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy, man. Yo, let's fast forward, man, out of the big tune. Let's go to the modern day MTK experience. You know what I'm saying? And about 2016, man, I know you had a major downturn with the music. Of course, depression starts creeping in. How did you deal with that, man, and use it to even improve your mental health standing?
I think it just realizing I had failed and just embracing that is what really helped me, because just feeling like I finally came to terms with it is like, fuck, finally. Like, okay, you know, I rock bottomed. You know, this is... I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to get on big records. I'm not going to do any of this stuff. And that's okay, because I gave it my best shot. So that wasn't an easy pill to take, because for so long I had associated my personal identity with the fact that I did music. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that I did it at a high level. So having to partition my personal self away from that had me kind of floating off in the ether, like, well, who am I? What, you know, if I don't do this, then what am I? Like, what am I really doing out here? And I stopped thinking about it in such, you know, black and white terms. And I started to realize that, you know, I do have other interests outside of this. And I am enjoying life in spite of not doing this anymore. And being able to come to terms with that and realizing that, hey, I like to walk. Wow, that's a novel concept. I'll walk out in the sunshine for like 2 hours. And finding habits like, or hobbies like that, video games, going to nice restaurants, cocktails, things like that, that I had really not done much in my youth. That's what helped me kind of go back to square one and realize that, okay, this is a part of who I am and I want to do this, but I want to do it without the expectations of success.
I can dig that. I can dig that, man. We all often do it, man, but, you know, I got to ask you why. What made you seek so much validation and associate your identity with being successful, like, you know, being around those people, things like that?
Well, two words, imposter syndrome. Like, I'm not really, like, am I really good enough to be here or am I just lucky? You know, and not having a clear answer to that, because I would hear stuff that other people would do. I'm like, man, I'm not that good. Like, I'm not as good as like Trox, or I'm not as good as these other people. Like, am I in my position for what reason, right? And once you start to let that kind of negative thought, you know, process kind of ruminate in your mind, then you start looking to being around other people to validate who you are and validate the reason why you're doing what you do. And that time after G-Unit, where things got real struggular, right? People stopped hitting me up. I had people, you know, hit me with that, hey, you still doing that little music thing? Type shit, you know.
Common.
Gotta look.
So I was getting all that. I had people like, hey, man, since you're not making beats anymore, let me buy all your samples and drums for $100, like stuff like that. So I wasn't getting like the attention that I was accustomed to. And since that was so directly related to my self-worth due to my imposter syndrome feelings, it was really, really hard to break away from that. But no, absolutely. The validation from others was because I wasn't convinced that I was the person that I thought other people thought I was.
Understandable, man. Yeah, we all go through that, man. And what was the turning point? What made you decide to use that very same energy and stay creative? Like, you know what? I'm going to pull myself out of this shit. I know I'm dope. How do I get back to creating? What made you stay creative?
Just the same reason, the same thing that made me start doing it when I first started. That's just loving the work, loving the iterative process of starting from not being good, being all right, being okay, and then making your way to like something that's, you know, passable is good. So loving the work, loving the idea of figuring something out on a day-to-day basis and, you know, ending each day a little bit better off than the one before, and then not having the pressure of other people like judging what I do, it was amazing. It's just the only opinion that it made me, it reminded me, centered me on the fact that the only opinion that mattered was my own.
That's 100% where we have to be as far as our mindset. As long as we're having fun, being creative, and it's fulfilling, I always felt like everything else would take care of itself after that, man. So let's talk about your whole outlook after that moment, man. When did you get back to, like, full-fledged, like, you know what, I'm back down, man. I'm doing this. And you know what? I even wouldn't mind collaborating with some other people, man. What was that moment that made you say, you know what, the show must go on?
When I made something that I wanted to listen to over and over and over and over and over again, just like when I would make something, like, you know, when you make a beat and you just know it's going to end up on a record, like as you're making it, like this is going to definitely end up somewhere. Someone's going to record to this. So I got that same feeling. And I sent off to a handful of people at first. I sent some stuff to Vanderslice because I would always send him everything that I ever did. Because he's one of the most punch you in the gut type feedback types ever. And it's invaluable to have people like that. But I sent to the Static Selecta because he had just followed me on Twitter because we were both on a record by a guy named AG DeCorner. And shout out to him. So Static's like, I like these, send more. So I'm like, oh, so someone at that level likes what I'm doing right now, you know? And then I got hit up by Jake One. He's like, hey, send me something. Because I would post these on my Instagram stories, right? And back then I only had like a couple hundred followers, but it was a lot of old people from the music, you know, business in the city. So I'm from Seattle. So guys like Jake One, you know, Vitamin D, folks like that are, you know, still following me. So getting a handful of people to see that are operating on what I consider to be like a top tier level, it really just made me think, okay, maybe there's something here more than, you know, what I'm doing.
Dope. That's dope, man. So you got Static Select rocking out over your packs. Jake One is asking you to send them through, man. You start picking back up steam. You know what I mean? After that, like, did it like turn into a snowball effect? Who else hit you up, man, besides those guys?
Oh, wow. I've been... Dre's team hit me up. I just got hit up by Timbaland today.
Nice.
Which is really cool because like that's my hero. Cash Money AP hit me up eventually. Shout out to him. He's one of my favorite people I ever worked with. He's like, he's a top A plus human being. Like a lot of just people who aren't really like at the level yet, but they're just about to be there are the ones who hit me up. And they're the ones there that are the most exciting for me to work with. Like I got hit up by a guy named Hamad Beats, and he was just some like 18-year-old kid and just a producer, but I could tell he was good. Like you could listen to someone and, you know, you could hear how they mix their drums and you're like, okay, this person's legit. And I definitely felt that way about him. I ended up doing 4 songs with him on a Trippie Redd album from last year.
That's major, man. That's dope. That's dope, man. So that's refreshing, man. You know, I often like to grab those up-and-coming ears and I like to say appetites. Those guys are hungry. They're creating nonstop. No shameless plug real quick, but shout out. He's crushing it on BeatStars, man. You know what I'm saying? Cash Money AP crushes it on BeatStars. That's our sponsor, so I had to throw that out there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, man, working with the youngsters, the up-and-comer, man, they keep you sharp because they have a whole different outlook and perspective on music. With that being said, man, I know, like, all these people hit you up and everything, man, and, you know, you get the roughs and stuff. I know the hard drives got to be, like just full of bangers, man. Like, how much unreleased stuff do you have, really, just sitting around, like, man, I should leak this shit one day, you know what I'm saying?
I got my fair share. A lot of it I've just heard about. I would say the majority of my unreleased music right now is probably with Kanye. and I got some stuff that probably will never see the light of day because he switched to religious music, and I got in right before he made that switch. So hopefully I get to make some new stuff with him. And I work closely with his team, so I imagine that'll happen sometime. And they're great people, man. Shout out to Boogs the Beast. He's like one of my favorite people I work with.
Oh, absolutely, man. Me and Boogs go way back. I'm from Chicago. Boogs is from Chicago. Yep. We go way back to the Goon Squad days, Bump J, Welcome to Grimyville, mixtapes, all that good stuff.
Wow. Yeah.
So that is dope, man. But yeah, Boogs is an exceptional person, I must add. So
yeah, he's great. So Kanye, I just got an unreleased song with Pusha T in my inbox randomly.
Nice.
With a sample clearance request like last week. And I'm like, okay, typically don't get the songs. But that's awesome. I got a lot of beats from a lot of people. I got a lot of Cash Money AP beats with my stuff on them, or that we worked on together. But a lot of times I hear it when the album comes out, like both of my Logic songs, I heard when the album dropped. My Trippie Redd songs I heard on his Instagram when he was just posting, like smoking blunts and like listening to music, you know, like the young kids do on Instagram Live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't got a ton, but I got a lot of beats from people. There's a Jake 1 beat that I've been trying to get. It's called EVT to the World, because that's actually the city I'm from. I'm from Everett. And that's him clowning on me a little bit in the beat out, but it's crazy. It's like one of my favorite beats that I've ever heard someone do with mine. Shout out to Jake 1.
He's insane, man.
It's the big homie.
So I also, you know, myself, and I think Trox can attest to this as well. Not sure about Candy, but if you're not using them, you should be. The kits, man, that you release, you know, via Drum Broker and all that stuff, man, are simply amazing. I remember, like, randomly you sending them out. You're like, yo, check it out, man. Like, 7,000 kits later, bro. Wow.
7,000
kits,
that's,
man.
Crazy.
That's fucking amazing, bro. Like,
how many do I have?
How'd you sell so many goddamn kits, man? 7,000 kits, man. Those fucking sample clearance emails. That Gmail must be crazy.
You know, the way it started originally was I put out one kit, right? And it did all right. And then a producer was like, don't put any of the good stuff on the next kit. Don't do it. Because I got placements for every single one of them. And I'm like, okay, well... And I had this like little voice in my ear just telling me, it's like, just put all the good shit on the kids. Let the cards, you know, let the cards fall where they may. If he wants to get mad about it, so be it. And I did that. And that was volume 2. And that's when I really started to sell well. Because I had all this stuff. Because I had been making samples for like a year before this. And like I started to get good, like not like 3 months into it. So I had like a 9-month backlog. So I was just knocking the kits out every like 3-4 weeks. And what's really helped now is that I got so many kits out. I think I got like 34, 35. Like other guys like Soul Surplus, they got like 100 something. So I'm nowhere near them. But the sales are really helped nowadays by releasing kits that cost less money. And a lot of that's just to help people that, you know, we have like 6 million people in the country that are on unemployment right now. Not everyone, like $30 can be like a significant financial decision for people. I know it's been for me at different points in my life. So doing that and also running discounts so people can buy stuff for a lower price, and also releasing bundles so people can buy things at a discount that are already discounted. So not gouging people is how I've managed to do that and keep my quality bar up. That's been my key.
Indeed.
I love it, man. It's very honorable too, man, especially, you know, due to the circumstances going on all over the world, man. Keeping people creative is extremely important, you know, during this time, man. But that's a hell of an accomplishment, man. Congrats on that. 7,000 kits, man. That is insane.
That's a lot, man.
Fuck it. I got to send you some of the heat I made to some of the kits. You know what I mean?
Hey, like, hey, you already know. Yeah, hey, Matt, you already know I've sent you some heat with your samples too. And I still got plenty more to go.
Yeah. Oh, I bet. I sent some of the tracks ones that we did to YG like last week.
Oh, that's dope.
Oh, man.
I haven't heard anything back, but see, Trox and I both like rap music from Houston, and I can tell that because I can hear it in the way he makes beats.
Absolutely.
Those are my favorite personally, so I hope he picks one.
I appreciate that, man. Speaking of your library, man, every cover of the kit has your dog in it.
It does.
What's the dog's name, first of all, and what's the story behind that?
My dog's name is Gizmo. He is a 9-year-old Dachshund Corgi mix.
Ah.
He's adorable. He doesn't like me. That's the unfortunate part of the whole shit. I've literally put him on like 20-something covers, and he clearly prefers my wife, like in every aspect. Like, I take the dog to use the bathroom, but that's about it. That's my usefulness. The story is like, how many covers can you make, right? And like the sample pack covers is like, I felt like a lot of them were taking themselves too seriously. My first one was volume 4, the first one that he was on, and it was him in space, and there's this photo that we had taken that we turned into a logo where it looks like he's got 2 feet at the bottom, but it's actually his foot, his penis. My dog's exceptionally well hung, so it's an inside joke on the covers. And so he's in space, and also there's the USS Monte Cristo. Is a spaceship on the cover, and that's the apartment that my dad moved into when he got out of prison and moved up to Washington in like 96. So it's like those little like personal references, you know. And then I just went apeshit with all of them, and I started doing like, okay, well, what do I like? I like wrestling. Let's give them a pro wrestling cover. I still like wrestling. Let's do two. Let's give them, you know, a cover where I have them all framed on my wall. I'm looking at them right now. Let's give them a No Limit cover. And like, my wife will come up with these ideas a lot of the time. And how absurd can we possibly get? Like, we had one where he was on Instagram Live and girls are shaking their ass behind him and there's like blunt smoke and
stuff
like that.
That's my favorite one.
That's the one right there, man.
It's like, why take yourself serious? It's not that serious, man. I mean, I'm making music. I'm making samples or loops and Fruity Loops that are trying to sound like they were made in the 70s, and I sell them on the internet. Like, I don't look at myself like a savant or anything like that. I have this like little niche that I'm decent at. So why not interject some humor into it and provide some levity instead of, you know, self-importance? So that's really the reason why I do it.
With all that being said, man, hit all these incredible milestones, work with all these dope-ass artists that we all respect, man. What's next for the Crabtree Music Library?
Right now, I'd say that doing what I'm doing right now is good. I don't want to sign anybody. I don't want to expand like that. I don't have the time or patience for it. I'm just going to keep on doing what's fun, and making samples is what's fun. And if they wind up, you know, making it on a record, great. And if they don't, I still had fun making it. So more of the same, staying consistent, having fun, and trying to get better at what I do.
I love that, man. That's when it's dope. When you're complete bliss and just having fun, you know, getting better at your craft and making shit that's literally making the music industry better and sound doper. Because some of the stuff I've heard, I just flat out know. I was like, oh man, that's definitely something from Matt right there. You know what I'm saying? Like, definitely want to extend a thank you for that, man. Like, creativity is at an all-time low right now. So, you know, you sit there literally making compositions for people to use and spark, you know, the next great producer or some creative ideas, even in myself or Trox or Candy, whoever is out there, Cash Money AP, that just needs that extra spark, man. You know what I mean? We appreciate that. Man, where can we find you online, social media, all that stuff?
Yeah, no doubt. My Instagram and Twitter handle is MTKSAYS. MTK Says.
Yes, sir, man. Well, it was a pleasure having you on this evening.
Thank you.
We heard some wild stories and shit, man. And
indeed, we do.
Got a lot more insight and perspective, man, how this process all works, man. and we appreciate it, man. Anything else you want to say to the people out there?
Just everyone, first off, thank you all for the great interview. Had an absolute blast talking about all manner of things. To the people who buy my kits, thank you, you know, for the constant support. I can't even put into words how much I appreciate it. And it's, you know, for some of the other people out there that, you know, may think that their, you know, goose is cooked or their ship has sailed, it's not always the case. Just center yourself on doing what you do for fun and because you enjoy it, and not in the pursuit of some sort of success that you feel like you need to reach. And you might find yourself getting closer than not.
That's what's up, man. Well, with that being said, y'all, we're going to get up out of here. On behalf of myself, Ill Brown, my co-host,
I'm Trox,
and your girl, Candy.
And that little voice on MTK's shoulder that's like, leak those fucking Kanye records. Leak them. We forbid you ado. It's been real. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Beat the Block. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. It helps the show a lot. See you on the next episode. Peace.